Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Run ahead of them, get a head start, and I'll follow you.
Thank you guys very much.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else the Iditarod, and catching up sometimes if you're not already out in front or maybe catching up with your friends. I will explain what I mean about all of that. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. Those were some dog mushing sounds there to start us off. Gnome-grown Nenana musher Aaron Burmeister, in fact, parking his team in McGrath when he was out in front at the time. It is now Wednesday, though, as I'm recording this anyway. Iditarod teams have been mushing down the thousand-mile trail for three full days, and I mentioned catching up because our little team is trying to get caught up, trying to get you all caught up, really, on the race. We'll do that with some sounds from Roan, Nikolai, the first Alaska Native village on the trail, as well as more from McGrath. And we'll catch up with Epayauk Raitan, one of a handful of Native mushers in this year's race, and the first out trans woman to compete in Iditarod. We'll also have another DOD, Dog of the Day, that is, and a listener question answered by a dog musher. So, as can happen, the unpredictable weather clashed with logistics and travel for our little team Monday night and Tuesday. Our trail reporters Jeff Chen and Lex Trinan were both stuck without access to internet to file anything really from the field for different reasons, though. For Jeff, it was a bad Wi-Fi password. A woman at City Hall in Nikolai, where Jeff was staying Monday night, told me that she had given him all of the letters that were in the password, but none of the numbers, which seems problematic. She was really nice about it, though, and mostly we're just happy that Jeff was warm and safe. That's because we hadn't really heard from him or Lex for a little while, and that is because Lex was stuck in Roan, which isn't a community with any kind of fancy amenities like internet, really just a cabin and a few other structures there. Pilot Rob had dropped him off there to talk to mushers, but he couldn't get back. He apparently had a strong headwind and not enough fuel, so Lex had to hole up in a wall tent, sleep on a cot. Luckily, he was also safe and sound, just unable to call or send us anything. He has, since then, though, been able to send us this piece of tape that he recorded while he was in Roan.
So I'm walking across, I don't know what river it is, some river. It's that where Roan is, the checkpoint of Roan. It's kind of blowing pretty steady. I'm walking from this camp that our pilot, Rob, has set up on the other side of the river. It's an old mining exploration camp that I guess he bought, but I was basically stranded there last night. Roan is basically one little postal office, former postal office, along the Iditarod mail route. There's not much around here. There's a few cabins and tents scattered around, but they're all pretty spread out. Anyway, last night Rob was supposed to pick me up after he dropped Jeff off in Nikolai, but the wind was too strong, so he couldn't make it here, and he had to turn around midway through his flight. From what I understand, I've only been receiving a few messages here and there from my satellite phone, my InReach. So that's my understanding. Last night I spent sleeping on a cot, on a foam mattress, with my sleeping bag that luckily I brought. I did get a gas lamp started, so I had some light. Kind of had some cold prepackaged meals for dinner. Then had a tortilla that I toasted on top of the oil stove. And had that with some Nutella for a nice hearty breakfast this morning. Anyway, hoping to get out of Roan soon. I'm going to go over to the checkpoint and see if there's any mushers around there.
So that's a little taste of Lex's experience there in Roan. Pilot Rob was able to fly in and get him to Nikolai, Jeff to McGrath. So they've both made it farther down the trail, like most of the mushers, frankly, And that's why we're now playing catch up. We'll take a closer look at some more up-to-date race standings in a little bit. But I think probably the best way to get caught up is to go in chronological order as opposed to what, I don't know, alphabetical order. Anyway, since the start on Sunday, Iditarod teams passed from the rolling foothills of the Alaska Range into some of the most challenging terrain of the trail on their way from Finger Lake to Roane and then on to Nikolai. That's about a quarter of the way into the race. Lex caught up, there's that phrase again, caught up with some mushers in the checkpoints of Roane and Nikolai to get their take on this year's trail.
Dallas CV blitzed into the Roane checkpoint, hardly more than a log cabin and a clearing in the woods. Like other top teams, he described good trail conditions with plenty of snow.
But no, I mean, the gorge is beautiful, man. It was really nice.
As he tore through his supply bag searching for snacks and extra sled runners, he said his biggest challenge was his enthusiastic dogs.
They act like they haven't done anything all winter, so they've been bombing down here at 100 miles an hour.
It's hard for mushers not to be impressed by Dalzell Gorge, which is one of the most dangerous sections of trails. It's marked by steep downhills and tight, twisty turns. After making the plunge with her team, Millie Porseld stopped for some rest in Roane and slurped down a vacuum-sealed bag of cold spaghetti.
It's such a privilege to go through there on this trail. I mean, through the pass and through that gorge, it's just unbelievable to me that there is a trail through there.
Teams farther back in the pack didn't get to see much of the trail. They raced down the gorge in darkness. On top of that, many of them got stuck in a storm that rolled in as they climbed Rainy Pass before the gorge. Rookie Bridget Watkins said visibility was bad.
There was no trail from the team that was in front of me, which hadn't been very long in front of me, but it was blowing sideways up there, so it was literally marker to marker there for a minute.
The pre-dawn darkness made running down Dalzell Gorge even more harrowing.
And it's just, you know, zip, zip, zoom, zag, bing, bang, boom, like a ping pong ball, you know, through there. You just got to drive, you know. I can see how people definitely will break sleds, which...
Near her sled, Eric Kelly had done just that. His brush bow, a rounded attachment in the front of his sled to keep his runners from getting hooked on trees, had snapped off in a collision. Rookie Gerhard Tihart of South Africa also had a misstep. After a rough ride on a descent that involved several strong bumps into trees, he turned a sharp corner to realize his lead dog was missing. Somehow its clip had broken in one of the collisions, allowing it to run ahead. Eventually, he found it at a stop. Another rookie, Matt Pavelio, says that while he avoided major mishaps in the gorge, he got glimpses of what could happen through his headlamp.
You know, you can see where people have been way off down into the ditches, and you cross like ice bridges, and there's like 10-foot drop-offs on either side into, you know, who knows, some abyss.
Later in the pack, racers took the time to recharge at Roane, something that gave Joe Taylor a boost.
I just put on a fresh pair of socks for the first time, and my mood is like totally changed.
Mushers took any help they could get as they charged from Roane into another crux of the race. After crossing the South Fork of the Kuskokwim River, racers ran into hilly spruce terrain on a narrow trail. Before long, the spruce trees turned into skeletons, a result of a forest fire a decade ago that left the terrain exposed to wind. At the Athabascan village of Nikolai, the next checkpoint, teams arrived throughout the day on Tuesday. Many, like Hugh Neff, looked exhausted. He described those wind-blown mountains. He says pressing on the brake tore out the dust and clay that was on the ground.
All that clay comes up in the air, or dirt or whatever it is, and it goes, you know, in your eyes and your nostrils. You can barely see the trail. It's like you're in a coal mine or something.
At one point, Neff's sled tipped on its side, and he got dragged along, stopping only when he yelled to the musher he was following to stop, which forced his team to stop as well. Things hardly got better for most teams. A long, monotonous run through the flatlands out of the mountains were beat down into moguls by snow machiners who'd passed through a few weeks ago. Neff said his 55-year-old arms were exhausted by the constant bumping.
I got a few Tylenol in the system right now.
Now Neff says he's ready for some smoother running as he heads towards McGrath. Reporting in Roane and Nikolai, I'm Lex Trinan.
Those sections of trail, like Lex said, can be really technical and tough, even when there's been plenty of snow. In a bad snow year, though, there's icy, bumpy, bare ground and stumps. It's much more difficult to slow down. And mushers do that by stepping off their sled runners with one foot and pushing down on a metal brake that digs into the ground to really get the team to slow down. So when there isn't snow there and it's just ice or, like frozen mud, it really doesn't work as well. Not only is it really bumpy, but you can't slow down as well. You just kind of have to hold on for dear life. We heard from Hugh Neff in that previous story. I talked to him while I was in Nikolai in 2014 when the conditions in the Dalzell Gorge and the Farewell Burn, according to a lot of mushers, were the worst that they had ever seen. Hugh Neff agreed back then, and he had his broken brake, a sheared in half solid metal bar, to prove it. That same year, mushing in the race, Aaron Burmeister seriously injured his knee before arriving in Nikolai. Like a lot of people who were there at the time, I still remember him hobbling around, taking care of his dogs, hobbling to the village clinic. The speculation at the time among everyone there was that he was for sure going to have to scratch from that race. Somehow he toughed it out and actually made it all the way to Nome, which is pretty wild because Nikolai, like I said, is only a little over a quarter of the way into the race. This year, on Tuesday morning, Burmeister was the first to arrive in Nikolai, and our reporter Jeff Chen recorded a brief exchange with a race watcher who commented on the knee.
It's sore today.
Oh, my.
A lot better than it was doing back then.
I can't believe he actually finished that one with all that going on.
The doctor said, Aaron, guys get carried off the football field for far less than this.
Yeah, they do.
I said, I had ibuprofen with me, and I just dealt with the pain.
And then Jeff had a chance to record a quick interview with Aaron Burmeister.
Just kind of curious what the trail conditions were like. Looks like you went over some gravel.
We had about 20 miles of bare ground. We had river crossing with lots of open water. And then we had about 50 miles of really rough moguls and glare ice mixed together. So it was an exciting trail. We made it here in one piece. I'm ecstatic to be here. And dogs are healthy and I'm healthy. So that's the important thing.
Why was there so much open bare ground?
Well, it's the wind and the warm weather you guys had here last week. Thawed everything out, so it melted and refroze into glare ice. So it certainly made it made it real exciting.
From Nikolai, Burmeister mushed onto the little Kuskokwim River town of McGrath, an aviation hub for the area. As I'm recording this, Burmeister is still settled in there for his 24-hour break. That's mandatory, and there are some parameters on where mushers have to take that 24-hour break, but they don't all have to take it in the same spot. Anyway, for getting to McGrath first, Burmeister won gifts from the locals, including a beaver skin hat and a pair of beaded beaver skin mittens.
Beautiful. Let me see how they fit with my gloves on. Look at that. They're made for me.
Ooh, those are beautiful.
Those are gorgeous. Thank you very much.
And because this is 2022, before Burmeister's dogs were able to pull the sled into the rest area, the musher had one more requirement, a COVID test, of course. It was the last of the four required tests for mushers competing in this year's race. Race marshal Mark Nordman called the race doctor over towards the check-in area. That's Dr. Jody Guest.
So one more thing, Dr. Guest.
Oh, yeah. Fun part.
Dr.
Gett,
please.
Did you get to park for a little bit?
Yeah, I'd like to park 24-hour parking.
Okay.
Well, guys.
Cool. Nice. Oh, look at his getting his COVID swabs.
I should note that what would usually be the next checkpoint after McGrath, the village of Takotna, opted out of being part of the Iditarod this year to avoid any risk of the race bringing in coronavirus. A local decision there based on how they felt about it and the members of their community and the risk level that coronavirus posed to them. Takotna, another pretty popular spot to take a 24, but not this year. So with Burmeister stopped for his 24-hour break there in McGrath, other mushers pushed on to take theirs farther down the trail. I was not surprised to wake up this morning to see that in the lead was Brent Sass, aiming for his first Iditarod championship after placing third last year in his sixth race, so his seventh race this year. He's followed by five-time and defending champ Dallas Seavey, who's looking to become the winningest musher in Iditarod history if he can pull off a sixth win this year. Sass had actually taken a roughly four-hour break in the ghost town checkpoint of Ophir. That's, I think, a little bit over a third of the way into the race. And then Seavey just stopped long enough to talk to the checkers, probably grab some supplies out of his drop bags. And then he took a break a little bit farther down the trail where Sass and some other mushers coming along later ended up passing him. That is not uncommon in this race. The teams, again, are on different run-rest schedules, so depending on where they're at, they're going to get passed while they're off the trail taking care of their dogs and giving them some rest as they need to do. just to take a look at the Iditarod.com GPS tracker to see where those front runners are. Brent Sass is still currently in the lead. He's approaching the checkpoint of Cripple, and I would assume arrive there in the next hour or two. Dallas CV is behind him something like 20 miles or so. Behind Dallas CV is former Yukon Quest champion Hugh Neff, two-time champion, I believe, and three-time Iditarod champion Mitch Seavey, Dallas's dad, of course. And then you have Ryan Reddington of the famous Reddington family that started the Iditarod to begin with. So that's where things stand right now, at least for those front runners, although there are still teams spread out all the way back to Nikolai, really. And depending on when you're listening to this, getting all caught up, I'm sure all of that will change. One person we've been looking forward to catching up with is Epa Yauk Raitan, who, as we've noted before, is the first out trans woman to compete in the Iditarod. Raitan did run the race in 2019 before transitioning and making this historic run in 2022. When not mushing all over the Arctic, Raitan spends time in Norway and went to school there and has mushed dogs for tourists with the family kennel there. Also does polar bear tours out of Koktovik on Alaska's North Slope, also with the family business. I should note that her father, Ketil Raitan, ran the Iditarod each year from 1991 to 1994, then returned in 2016, 17, and 18, so definitely an Iditarod finisher and veteran. Her brother, Vebjorn Raitan, raced the 1,000-mile Yukon Quest in 2018. Epa Yauk is also a Rookie of the Year from running the Yukon Quest a few years ago. And also, I said when they're not mushing all over the Arctic, they do all these other things, because whether it was Epa Yauk or Vebjorn, Ketil and his kids also have a history of taking their dog team all the way from Nome to Koktovik, which, if you go look at a map, is a long way. And they have done this at least twice right after the Iditarod. So get the dogs from Anchorage down the little ceremonial trail in Anchorage to Willow, mush them in the Iditarod from Willow to Nome, and then also with a snow machine going alongside, depending on who's mushing the dogs and who's riding the snow machine, two of them would have taken the dogs all the way around the coast to Koktovik. Epa Yauk is also into photography and just a really interesting person all around. I've been following her on Twitter for a few years now, and you can find her at twitter.com/epayauk1, and that's APAYAUQ1. She's mushing a B team for former Iditarod champ Jor Leifseth Olsom, a good friend of Raitan's who shares that Norwegian connection. Anyway, Lex caught up with Epa Yauk Raitan in Nikolai just a little while ago, actually.
The dogs are doing great. The sled was a down angle on a surface where steering didn't do anything. So my sled went on the wrong side of the tree. So one of my runners is bent. So I think it's going a bit crooked, but it's still in one piece. In the burn there was a, or after it, there was a really steep downhill that I kind of fell off, partly off of the sled. I was just holding on to my handlebar, and my headlamp battery fell out of my pocket. All my ointments and stuff fell out of my pocket. My gun fell out of my pocket, and that was in a really steep downhill, and I had just pretty recently passed the team. So it was pretty scary to set the hooks and go and get those things, not knowing if the other team was going to come down that hill any second. So right now I'm going to change my runner plastic, because going through the burn there's a lot of bare ground that we go over, and rocks, and on the rivers outside of Rome.
So what does that do to the plastic?
It scrapes up the plastic. I could You can see here there's some pretty deep caches.
That piece of tape is from Wednesday, but a while before the race, our colleague and friend Shady Grove Oliver did 4 hours of interview with Apayauk Raitan for a story that ran in the Guardian newspaper. Maybe go check that out. It's pretty good writing, I think. Then edited for us a good-sized chunk of that interview for us to use here at the Identipod, another bonus extended interview episode chunk. Raitan's team, that your B team at this particular moment in time, is running in 43rd out of the 49 teams. And to make a sort of segue out of this, they've been running pretty close to Lisbeth Norris's team of Siberian Huskies. I mention her and those beautiful Siberian Huskies because it's a dog on her team named Steve, who is our dog of the day.
I do have a favorite. His name is Steve. And he's kind of a jerk, and I think he would, in his ideal life, he would be my only dog. And he's just such he's such a love bug. Like, he's so wriggly and happy, and he has me wrapped around his little paws when I go to put his booties on. Like, he doesn't really like to have his booties on, and so he just like rolls around and acts really cute. But he's a really hard-working dog. But at the same time, so personable, and I just enjoy being with him.
Yeah. And you said he was a jerk. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, he, a lot of my runs are spent going, Steve, Steve, because he wants to pick on his neighbor.
Oh, gotcha. And how old is he?
He's 4.
And what position does he run?
Wheel by himself.
Oh, really? That's kind of unique, right?
It's not so unique in places where there's tight technical trails, but it's for that reason, and also because then I don't have to worry about him bullying anybody.
Lisbeth Norris talking to Lex Trinan there about her dog, Steve, who sounds like a hard worker but a little bit of a bully, so she keeps him close to her, close to the sled, in the wheel position by himself, so not with another dog right next to him, I suppose, so she can tell him to knock it off. Steve, Steve. Very cute. And those Siberians, just beautiful dogs. If you want to get a look at one, you can take a look at Steve. That's at alaskapublic.org, along with our other dog profiles. And you may notice that our Identipod logo actually features a Siberian Husky. So you've probably seen that by now, I would imagine. And now we have another recurring segment for the Identipod. It's time for our listener question.
This is Adrian Hills in Erie, Pennsylvania. I'm one of the knitters who follows the race along with the Initerod, and I wondered if you could tell me more about how the mushers find their way. I know they wear GPS units so that they are tracked and I can see them on the map, but how do the mushers themselves know where the trail is? Is it simply by following the trail markers, or is there something else I don't know about? Thanks.
Here's Deke Nachtigaborin answering that question.
Yeah, the trail is marked with, well, first of all, it's for the most part broken out with a snow machine crew, snowmobile crew. And then if it doesn't snow or anything, you can see the trail really obviously. And then every, I don't know, tenth of a mile is a wooden lathe with a certain paint pattern and a little blue flag on it. And those aren't so important when it's nice and sunny and clear weather, but when storms are blowing and stuff, it's like, where's the next marker? Where's the next marker? Where's the next marker? And you start linking up marker to marker to marker. So that's when they become really, really important. And as far as GPS, I carry one. I don't use it for navigation, though. I use it for the stats of my team. So how fast we're going, how far we've gone, how far to the next checkpoint, so on and so forth. I guess it is nice to have in case I did lose a trail or something, but I don't usually use GPS for much navigation. So, yeah.
Well, and are there cases where it's like too windy or it's confusing where the trail markers are, and like how do you navigate it then?
Then it's just trying to find, like, for example, coming into Nikolai today, it's on a lots and lots and lots of glare eye sections, and since I wasn't first, my lead dogs just kind of learned to follow the scratch marks in the ice, so on and so forth. And there was actually a couple water crossings that we got a little bit confused on. So we just had to kind of park the team, and I go out to my lead dogs and look across and kind of scan it out there and figure out where the right trail is. So
there's a little bit of dog judgment in addition to person judgment too.
Trust your dogs. Yeah, totally. It's amazing. not so far on this Iditarod, but in other races, I'm like, I can't see, guys, so I hope you know where you're going, because I don't. So and I guess even when there's good weather, you know, when the trees get real tight and stuff and you're going up, down, and around real tight corners, you just trust that your dogs know where they're going. So
do the dogs learn to see those trail markers, you think?
Yes, but not mine. So yet anyway. I've heard people swear that they can follow the trail markers. I've thought once or twice, but I don't know. I'm kind of on the fence about that. So
that's interesting. Yeah. And you hear mushers talk about these difficult moments. I mean, when it's a nice sunny day and you can see the trail right in front of you, no big deal. But in a big storm or something like that, you might have to just trust your dogs to sniff out that trail and find their way. And certainly if you're in front and there haven't been other teams that have gone through, that can be more difficult. We've seen it happen before. Mushers have gotten turned around and gotten off the trail, and just shows the importance of having a good lead dog or a number of dogs in your team that can lead and find the trail and be confident about where they're going and leading the rest of the team and yourself on the back of that sled. Well, Adrian, we really appreciate that question. Deke, we appreciate the answer. If you have a question about the Iditarod or dog mushing, send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. The best way to do it is how Adrian did it, by recording a voice memo of yourself, email it to us, and you could be on the Iditapod. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. Thanks to Tegan Hanlon, Jeff Chen, and Lex Trinan for all the hustle and bustle. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Awesome, Gabe.
Awesome, thank you.
And then what's your name?
Gabriel Petruska.
So, can you tell us how old you are?
Six.
Six?
I don't know.
Well, 1 second after this one, it's been good.
How do you feel about the Iditarod coming? I can't remember.
Do you have a favorite dog?
Yeah, it's my dog.
Good answer.
That's a good answer.
Yeah.